Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Sasha hated sand, the way it stuck to things for weeks. So when Maddie shared a surf trip on Expedia Trip Planner, he hesitated. Then he added a hotel with a cliffside pool to the plan. And they both spent the week in the water. You were made to follow your whims. We were made to help find a place on the beach with a pool and a waterfall and a soaking tub and, of course, a great shower. Expedia. Made to travel.
In 1969, a plan to show support for an anti-racism protest turned the lives of 14 promising black student athletes upside down. Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday the 13th of February, these are our main stories. Senior officials from the US, Egypt and Qatar are meeting in Cairo to discuss a ceasefire in Gaza. But there are warnings of a bloodbath if Israel insists on launching a ground attack on Rafah. Indian farmers face riot police as they head to Delhi from neighbouring states to protest. And the US Senate approves billions of dollars to support Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan. Also in this podcast, the former Thai leader Thaksin Shinawat is to be released from hospital where he's serving a prison sentence. And
if you look at a map that would paint the countries that have already legislated marriage equality in Europe, you will find that they are bunched in the north and in the west. Greece will break that mold.
Will Greece become the first majority Orthodox country to allow gay marriage? As we record this podcast, senior officials from the United States, Qatar and Egypt are meeting in Cairo to discuss a possible ceasefire in Gaza. The head of the Israeli spy agency Mossad is also reported to be attending the talks. They take place against warnings of a potential bloodbath if the Israelis insist on launching a ground attack in the southern Gazan city of Rafah. More than half of Gaza's population, around 1.4 million people, are now crammed into Rafah in appalling conditions. The head of the UN's relief agency for Palestinians is Philippe Lazzarini. He's warned that the thousands of displaced people sheltering in Rafah have nowhere to go.
There is absolutely no safe place in Rafah anymore, and the fear is that the number of people killed and injured might again significantly increase. And we are still talking about the largest military offensive in the middle of a sea of displaced people. They are asked to move. The question is where to move.
A spokeswoman for the Israeli embassy in London, Orly Goldschmidt, insisted it was up to Hamas to end the suffering of the Palestinian people.
I can assure you that we don't want to hurt civilians. We have never been at war with the Palestinian people. Our only war is against Hamas, and we will do everything we can in order to minimize the numbers of civilian casualties. But you know, there's a very simple equation here. If Hamas cares about their own civilians, they can just surrender today, and then we won't need this ground invasion.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Barbara Platasha, told me more about the latest talks.
These are the talks about the potential temporary pause in the fighting, which has been on the table for a while. A framework has been on the table drawn up by the intelligence chiefs of the United States, Qatar and Egypt, and approved by the Israelis. The Israeli Prime Minister very strongly rejected Hamas's terms last week, but the Americans are very, very much pressing this right now, as are other international allies. They are very much wanting to try to get at least a six-week pause in order to release the rest of the Israeli hostages and have a period of calm where they can really surge aid into Gaza. Now, despite Mr. Netanyahu's very strong comments last week, he has sent a high-level delegation to Cairo to continue the talks, and Israeli media says that was because of U.S. pressure, because Mr. Netanyahu's focus is trying to expand the offensive into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, whereas the Americans and the others are just saying, no, we need to have a pause.
We've heard from both Joe Biden and King Abdullah following their meeting in Washington. Are their comments likely to make any difference?
Well, I think it is pretty likely that the Israelis will send ground troops into Rafah, which is the last major population center in Gaza that has not seen the Israeli campaign. Their argument is that they need to go in order to defeat Hamas's last battalions, as they put it. They don't want to be in any position, leave Hamas in any position to be able to reconstitute itself. They seem to be quite insistent that they will do this. However, they have met a lot of opposition, so I don't think it's going to happen right away. So from the UN, for example, you know, Israel needs the UN in order to organize an alternate location, I guess, tent camps, really, for all the displaced people sheltering in Rafah. And the UN spokesman has said, well, we're not going to be party to forced displacement. You can't send people back to areas that don't have shelter, that have unexploded ordnance. There isn't a safe place in Gaza right now. So quite a bit of resistance from that quarter. And then, as I was saying, from international allies, too, warning about the humanitarian catastrophe. And Mr. Biden very pointedly asking for a credible plan to protect civilians, calling them exposed and vulnerable.
And just finally, considering the nature of Hamas and how they operate, can they be absolutely sure there is a set number of battalions in one place and getting rid of those will be the end of the matter?
What the Israelis say, they have numbers, you see. They say that there are 24 battalions, that they have defeated 18, that they are still fighting two in Khan Yunis, and that the remaining four are in Rafah. We have no way of independently verifying that, and I think there would be an argument for saying that Hamas is probably more fluid than that. And there are constituencies within the Israeli establishment who also question whether Hamas can really be defeated, given that it's very dug in, both physically in tunnels, but also otherwise in Gaza, doesn't necessarily operate like a, you know, an organized army, and has social and political and ideological support. So even if you get rid of a lot of Hamas fighters, there will be others who come to replace them, especially given the ferocity of the Israeli campaign against them. When it comes to the Americans who do support Israel's war aims, there is skepticism there too that Hamas can be totally defeated. But what they would like to see is its military capabilities degraded to the point that it would be unable to carry out another October 7th-like attack.
Barbara Platasha. Shortly after war broke out in the Middle East, the BBC World Service began following an ambulance crew from the Palestinian Red Crescent Society in northern Gaza. Journalist Feraz Al-Ayami filmed with the paramedics, witnessing them saving lives in areas hardest hit by Israeli airstrikes. Dalia Hadar of BBC News Arabic has sent this report.
Go straight to the ICU. She has a wound on her thigh, 6 centimeters deep. She also has injuries on her hand and eyes.
Mohammed has been a volunteer with the Red Crescent for a decade.
This war is one of the toughest I have seen. In the first 3 days, the number killed and the destruction was equal to the previous 4 or 5 wars together.
Back at base, he's wiping down a bloodied stretcher before the next call out.
We have seen too many horrors. We are tired. We'll need help with our mental health for years. All suffering we have seen, we want the war to end. Enough destruction. Enough.
The hardest day was when our colleagues were killed.
Basil Telli is one of the radio dispatchers for the Red Crescent.
It was October the 11th. We received a call about a target in a Brajneda area. There were casualties. Ambulance 515 headed there. Officer Yusril Masri, volunteer paramedic Ahmed Dahman, and volunteer paramedic Khalil Sharif, all dead.
The missiles burn people's bodies.
Volunteer paramedic Ala El-Halabi.
The occupation is directly targeting civilians, children, women, girls, elderly people. They destroy people's homes while they are inside, without any remorse, without any humanity.
The Israel Defense Forces said any claims that we intentionally target Red Crescent or medical workers is baseless and untrue. We act in accordance with international law and take feasible precautions to mitigate civilian harm in our operations.
The first thing that comes to mind when you hold the body of a dead child, holding your own child.
On October 27th, Israel cut off all communications to Gaza.
There have been no emergency calls, which puts civilian lives in grave danger and hinders our ability to reach those in need.
Those in need of urgent treatment and those in need of love. Rami can only communicate with his daughters in Rafah via the paramedics' radio. We're safe, they say. We miss you so much. His younger daughter, Asil. Tears on her cheeks. I'm missing you. Look after yourself. Rami drops the handset, cradles his head, and cries. A moment with his family, far from home.
You can watch BBC Arabic's full film, Gaza 101 Emergency Rescue, on the World Service YouTube page. Or, if you're in the UK, it's on the BBC iPlayer. Now, to India. The sounds of tear gas being fired by police targeting farmers heading to the capital Delhi from neighbouring states to protest. The farmers want the government to agree a guaranteed minimum price for the crops they grow. The capital has been turned into a fortress with blockades and tight security to try and avoid the chaos that ensued in 2020 when similar protests lasted more than a year and forced the government to eventually back down on proposed reforms. Since then, talks have taken place, but broken down. Sarvan Singh Pandur is the General Secretary of the Punjab Farmers Union, and he says the government have run out of time.
We thought that giving more time for the government was not suitable now. If there's a strong proposal, then we can think of giving them more time. But they don't have anything to offer.
Our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain is in Delhi.
Well, it's pretty incredible. You know, you're talking about farmers that are coming from three neighboring states into Delhi. And I'm in the city and I just took a spin around the city a little bit. And you can see several military, paramilitary forces and police forces out on the streets in central Delhi. And they're just preparing for these protesters potentially breaching those barricades and coming into the city. But remember, those borders are still more than 100 kilometers away. But that's just how prepared Delhi is for in case these farmers are able to breach those barriers. But remember, the barriers are actually concrete blockades. There are metal barbed wire. It's an incredible fortress, something that you would normally associate with an international border and not necessarily a state border in a country.
As we said, it's not the first time we've seen these sorts of protests. What are the demands of the farmers this time?
This time, the farmers are looking for a basic minimum price set for their crops. And from the farmers' perspective, they say that this was something they demanded at the last protest, or at least that was something that was promised to them at the last protest. So they feel that the government hasn't really gone through on that. They're also asking for more protections in terms of import-export pricing, and they really want India to actually withdraw from the World Trade Organization. And that's one of the big worries, right, is that as long as India starts entering into trade organizations, the market could get flooded from goods from other countries and therefore lessening the price of their goods here homegrown.
And the government responds, could it be coloured by the fact it's an election year?
Exactly. And I think that's why you're seeing such a strong response. Remember, last time the protests happened, it lasted a year, and the government certainly doesn't want that to happen this time around. Now, there have been negotiations that have been ongoing, and the talks broke down last night. Now, the government is saying that, look, we were close to a deal, but it didn't happen. And they haven't really made any mention of more negotiations that are going to happen today onwards. But you can expect that optically, this is not looking very good for the government and Prime Minister Modi, who is expected to widely win a third term in office.
Samira Hussain in Delhi. In Senegal, the political crisis is deepening. A second person was killed at the weekend in increasingly violent protests against President Macky Sall's decision to postpone the forthcoming elections. Several opposition contenders were barred from standing. But many say the president merely intends to cling to power beyond the end of his second term in April. Among the influential voices in Senegal are those of Muslim leaders. Nicolas Degos spoke to Ismaël Diaye, the General Secretary of Senegal's League of Imams, about why they feel betrayed by Macky Sall.
We reject it. We cannot accept to see our constitution be violated. The president takes an engagement. He makes his tour to see all the religious responsible to ask them to give him a chance to finish his second mandate. He finishes his second mandate. He has no right to postpone the election. What he does is not acceptable for us.
Have you shared your feelings with him?
Yeah, we shared it to him. We communication before his declaration to tell him we cannot accept. He cannot postpone this election. He cannot violate his engagement. He has to respect his people. And when we see he violate his engagement, we come again to tell him that we reject what he told to us.
You are talking about violation, but we know that there is a culture of respect between the political leaders and the religious leaders. We know that if you want to lead the country, you have to be in good terms. Mm-hmm. Do you feel betrayed?
Yeah, we feel it a lot, because when he wants his second mandate, he goes to all leaders, religious leaders, to ask them to help him, to give him a chance to have a second mandate and to finish with us. He has no right to ask third mandate. And that's why when he wants to postpone the election, when he wants to, you know, make his mandate continuous, we understand that he has, do not respect his words, and we feel very bad.
Do you support the initiative called Dead City, Les Journées, Les Villes Mortes?
Yeah, we have to use a peaceful way to show him how we feel very bad. We have not to destroy our country. We want our country to be safe. We want to have safety. We want to have a peace. That's why we will use all means, all peaceful means, to show him that we are not agreeing.
Imam, so now the new date of the election is the 15th December 2024. Are you saying that you're going to keep fighting until...
It's not possible. The constitution is not allow him to go up to 2nd April. It's not possible. How he can do? That's why he has to see the way to make this process continuous and to allow the candidate to follow the processes until 2 March to hold the election. And the winner will be the president of the Senegal after 2 April.
Ismaël Diaye, the General Secretary of Senegal's League of Imams. Thaksin Shinawat, one of Thailand's most influential but divisive politicians, is to be released from hospital, where he's been serving a prison sentence after returning from exile. The former telecoms tycoon and billionaire was twice elected prime minister and once owned Manchester City Football Club. I heard more from our East Asia regional editor, Celia Hatton.
Thaksin Shinawat was convicted while he was living in exile on a few different charges. The most notable one is when he sold his telecoms company, a large stake of it, $2 billion worth of his company, to a Singaporean entity. And it's believed that he didn't pay taxes on the deal. He was also convicted of corruption in a land deal involving his wife. He was ousted in a coup in 2006. He then went to live in exile. While he was in exile, he was convicted of these charges. It wasn't until he came back from exile last August that he was actually sentenced to 8 years in prison. But right from the start, his rivals believed that he was going to be set up for some preferential treatment. And that appears to have been what happened. His sentence was quickly changed to 1 year by the Thai king. And he actually never is believed to have spent a night behind bars. He immediately went to a hospital where he was reportedly receiving medical treatment, but he stayed in the luxury wing of the hospital where it's believed he had his own suite. So he's been there for the past 6 months. His family says he's had two operations, and now we understand he's quickly going to be able to go to his mansion in Bangkok, where he's going to be allowed to spend the rest of his sentence, another 6 months, before he's granted parole.
He is 74 years of age. Is there any prospect of him coming back to politics in Thailand?
Well, some might argue he's never actually left politics. He's actually thought to have sort of ruled Thailand from afar for many years. That's because the party that he founded, the Bhutai Party, is still quite powerful. In fact, the ruling party in Thailand, they're in coalition with the party's formal rivals from the military government. And so it's believed he's actually incredibly powerful still. His children are politicians. They have key roles in government. And so it's actually believed that he's still quite powerful, even though I should add that he's quite a polarizing figure. He's beloved in the countryside and among working class people, but other people living in Thailand cities believe that he actually became popular by giving handouts, and he's quite a populist politician. So he's a very divisive figure in Thai politics.
Celia Hatton. Still to come on this podcast, has a UK chemical manufacturer been negligent over the impact of pesticides in its products?
Remarkable personal stories.
Betrayal. It runs through my life and runs through my story.
Deep dive documentaries.
These children are using their own bags, not to carry books, but they carry the drug markets in Sweden on their shoulders.
And sport, but not as you know it.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
The BBC World Service tells the world stories. Search for Lives Less Ordinary, The Documentary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The fallout from Pakistan's election continues. It now seems the former Prime Minister, Imran Khan, is considering forming a coalition with some other parties. This is a change from earlier today, when this was ruled out. Mr. Khan is currently serving a 14-year prison sentence on various charges. Our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davies has been following the story.
Imran Khan earlier today ruled out working with three of the biggest parties. That was Nawaz Sharif's party, Bilawal Bhutto's party, and another party that is based in Karachi. Now, what he didn't rule out was joining with this particular party that he has now announced that they will be joining with. This party is a religious party and it has one seat in the National Assembly. But that is enough, because Imran Khan's, all of his independents can now join this particular party. And this has one massive benefit for Imran Khan. That is because one of the big fears that many of them had was that these independent candidates might get picked off one by one by some of the other big parties and reduce down Khan's overall vote total. So the fact that they're now joining this other party means that they will be in parliament and they won't be able to be picked off by other people. They'll have some form of party discipline. That helps him, but it doesn't get him to a majority. On the other side, we've also heard from Bilawal Bhutto, who has been in discussions with Nawaz Sharif's party. He has now said that his party will support Nawaz Sharif's party in the vote to get them into government, but he's not guaranteeing he's going to stay in an alliance with him. He said that they'll do that on a sort of ad hoc basis when that works for them and they agree with what things are going through. So the end result is that this looks like probably Nawaz Sharif's party will end up forming a government, although we haven't had official confirmation of it yet. But he will rule in a very fractured setup. And so it's very likely to be unstable and quite difficult in Pakistan in politics for some time.
There are some big issues facing Pakistan and they need stability.
Yes, they were looking for political stability after this election and they don't really seem to have got it. The major issue is the economy. They're meant to be having a deal with the IMF that will have to be negotiated this year. Problems with rising militancy, issues on the borders. There's lots of big issues facing Pakistan. And at the moment, it doesn't look like they're having a stable government to be able to deal with them.
Caroline Davies in Islamabad. After months of negotiations, the US Senate has passed a foreign aid package that will provide billions of dollars of funding to support Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan. The vote came after an all-night session and it was secured after 22 Senate Republicans sided with almost all of the Democrats. The Democrat Majority Leader, Charles Schumer, said this was one of the most historic bills the chamber had ever passed.
These past few months have been a great test for the U.S. Senate to see if we could escape the constant centrifugal pull of partisanship and summon the will to defend Western democracy when it mattered most. This morning, the Senate has resoundingly passed that test.
Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard told me about the importance of the bill.
It's extremely significant, Nigel. Basically, it provides, as you mentioned, aims to provide funds to Israel, about $14 billion, Taiwan and partners in the Indo-Pacific, humanitarian aid to Palestinians in Gaza, but also other conflict areas, and to US forces trying to defend shipping in the Red Sea. So there's a number of things, but the bulk of it, about two-thirds of that $95 billion, would be destined for Ukraine. And that really matters to Ukraine. There's lots of reports of Ukrainian soldiers on the front line suffering weapon shortages, and the US has been trying to provide some sort of military aid, but that's kind of petered out. Basically, they wanted this measure passed by the end of last year and it failed. There's a big political dispute ongoing in the US about the US border. There are Republicans who want that to continue. This year, of course, is a US presidential election. So although President Zelensky has thanked senators for passing this message, the money hasn't arrived in Ukraine. So it's a what next?
This will now go to Congress. What will happen there?
Well, the House of Representatives, the Speaker, has promised to block this bill. And a lot of Republicans have said it's dead in the water. So there is no money so far. It's just a step perhaps towards it. But it looks unlikely still.
Danny Eberhard. Greece may be about to become the world's first Orthodox majority country to legalise same-sex marriage. The bill, which will come to Parliament later this week, has been proposed by the Prime Minister, but dozens of his own MPs are expected to rebel, so he'll need opposition votes to get it through. And there's fierce resistance too from the Church. Our Southern Europe correspondent Mark Lowen reports from Athens.
In her garden in northern Athens, four-year-old Niovi plays make-believe, selling cakes from her imaginary shop.
Oh, wow, lovely.
Strawberry one.
Did you make them?
Yes.
For her two mums, Christina and Victoria, their dream might soon become real as Greece stands on the brink of legalising same-sex marriage. If it passes in a parliamentary vote on Thursday, Christina and Victoria will have their marriage, which took place in Britain, recognised in Greece. Niovi was born in London, but when they tried to register her with the Greek embassy, they were refused. And, says Victoria, welling with tears, it still hurts.
I was crying in the car. I couldn't stop and I still bring bad memories. It's like rejecting from your country.
What has been the impact in Greece of not having the law up until now?
My biggest fear is that if anything really bad happens to Victoria and she dies, then the child goes to social services to then see if any of her relatives or Victoria's relatives want to adopt her. And if they don't want to adopt her, then she goes into an institution. But I have no saying.
So you could have your daughter taken away from you?
Instantly.
It's a divisive issue here, played out in angry TV talk shows, with a recent poll showing a slim majority of 55% supporting the bill. It would also allow same-sex couples to adopt, but not have a baby through a surrogate. backed by the Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, though not by several of his MPs, it would make Greece the 16th member of the EU and 36th country worldwide to permit same-sex marriage, and the first one with a Christian Orthodox majority. Alex Pardelis is the Prime Minister's chief economic advisor and on the committee that drafted the bill.
It is often thought that human rights and equality is the purview of parties of the left, but in fact, this is coming from a centre-right party. It's important also to recognise that equality under law and equal individual rights is part of the ideology of the right. If you look at a map that would paint the countries that have already legislated marriage equality in Europe, you will find that they are bunched in the north and in the west. Greece will break that mold, will be the first country in the southeast.
Opposition is led from the powerful church, whose prelates read a letter condemning the move in services this month. Bishop Serafim, leading Mass in Piraeus near Athens, is one of the staunchest opponents. It's packed with worshippers in their Sunday best, kissing icons and bowing heads. He recently said he would block MPs who back the bill from his church and would refuse to baptize children of same-sex couples to teach them about the sin.
On Syntagma Square, outside Parliament, beneath banners reading No to same-sex marriage and No children for perverts, a couple of thousand people have gathered. Their chants include Take your hands off our kids. There's a video with images of Christianity and, oddly, Bill Gates. Conspiracies about a new global order being imposed have mixed with religious groups to protest over what they say will destroy Greek identity.
The Bible says that marriage is between man and woman. Like Sodoma and Gomorrah, the people there were practicing homosexuality and God destroyed the town.
It is a human right for every child to have a father and a mother. And we don't think that two homosexual people can give their right example.
Back in Niovi's garden, she practices her bike riding, watched by her mums, proud of the gradual progress by her and their country. They'll be in Parliament on Thursday, willing the vote to pass.
I'm amazingly happy about it. And it's a start. It's a start of accepting diversity in general as a country.
If the law passes, will there be tears?
Oh,
that's for sure.
That report from Mark Lowen in Athens. A BBC investigation has found that a UK chemical manufacturer being sued in the US over alleged links between its pesticide and Parkinson's disease failed to look at key health records in its own research. The weed killer Paracat is banned in Britain but is manufactured by Syngenta in Yorkshire and is exported around the world. Here's Malcolm Pryor.
It's known as the toxic pesticide so harmful that one sip can kill. Now, Paraquat's banned in the UK, but it is still exported to other countries. And in the US, thousands of farmers are taking legal action, claiming the chemical caused their Parkinson's disease. The manufacturer Syngenta has always insisted there's no evidence of a direct link. But legal documents seen by the BBC show the company's own key study of workers making Paraquat only looked at causes of death. Experts say at the time of the study, Parkinson's disease was underreported on death certificates and the company should have been looking at all workers' health records. But Syngenta told the BBC that wouldn't have provided informative results and it said it's conducted hundreds of studies evaluating the safety of the weed killer. Parkinson's campaigners are now calling for more independent studies to be carried out.
Malcolm Pryor. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Callum McLean, and the producer was Oliver Burlow. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.